Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners. If you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with Rob Sevier and Ken Shipley of the archival record label Numero Group. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll also share some of our favorite Numero Group tracks from over the years. Let's jump in.
This week we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of Numero Group, the archival record label based right here in Chicago, and I would dare say, Greg, the most successful and the most fastidious archival label since Rhino Records, the late lamented Rhino. They've brought new life and attention to the music of artists ranging from Syl Johnson to Blondie. And in addition to making rare music readily available, they've prioritized making both digital and physical products, like box sets, that are visually stunning, authentic, and full of fresh and original content.
We are joined by the Numero Group head honchos, Ken Shipley and Rob Sevier. Guys, you were on the show more than a decade ago. Welcome back. Glad to see you once again thriving on your 20th anniversary.
Thanks, Greg.
Hi, guys.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for having us.
You know, when we were talking to you years ago, keep pushing us back, you know, by the time I'll have us in the 19th century, it was focused on eccentric soul, primarily. You guys were digging out these incredible soul communities from decades past that had been buried unfairly, in your view, and resurrected some amazing music. But you've expanded incredibly since then, a ton of amazing music from various genres since. And I'd like to just highlight the fact that you are celebrating your 20th anniversary, huge event in L.A., with the following bands performing: Unwound, Codeine, The Hated, Karate, Ida, Chisel, Everyone Asked About You, Yui, Rex, and Tsunami. You know, none of these bands were on the Numero Group radar, you know, way back when the label was founded. So the expansion, genre expansion, talk about that a little bit. What was the thinking there to go beyond the original scope of the label?
Well, we sort of figured out at a certain point we were going to run out of road. We were going to run out of, you know, octogenarians to get on the phone. And, you know, so much of our business and the music that we release was made in the 60s and 70s. And just you get older and older and you stop being able to get the same people to, you know, agree to be on the label or to look into their music again. And so we thought it might be interesting to just kind of fast forward a couple of decades into an era that we both experienced at the time. And so we had some sort of proprietary knowledge about the music of that era that we thought we could bring a unique perspective to. And I always felt like Numero was more of a software than anything else. And that it was like, we built a really great system and, you know, we have a great way to make records and how to promote records, and that we could work on anything. And so it didn't seem that daunting to me.
Now, Rob, I gather that these were bands that both you and Ken loved in your teenage years, bands that formed you.
I was less formed by these bands. I mean, I was aware of some of them, Unwound and Codeine and a couple others that we're talking to. But this is a little bit more Ken's world. And in fact, I mean, you know, for him, it's a little more full circle because he worked with Ida and who's performing at Numero 20 and was much more part of like the Simple Machine scene, which is very much part of the Numero 20 experience. The Hated, Ida, Tsunami, we're all part of that world. Well, do you want to explain Simple Machines?
Simple Machines was just probably like the first DIY label to go out there and show everybody how it was done. They published this crucial thing called the Mechanics Guide, which was basically just like, here's everywhere you can get a record press, here's where you can get your labels made, here's who does covers. Yeah, and they were really generous with that information at a time, and it demystified making records for me, certainly as a teenager. I was a big fan of what Jenny and Kristen had done, and you know, we've been talking to them for years about the influence and impact that they had on our label and the way that I make records, and it sort of felt like a natural fit to get them into the universe.
You're talking about Jenny Toomey and Kristen Thompson.
I am.
Two terrific people who have done a lot for the independent music over the last three decades. So this is, an era well worth re-examining, I think. And obviously the other recent calling card has been that Blondie box set, right?
Yeah, it's another beast. You know, we're sort of used to working on projects in half decade to full decade length at this point. You know, we've done a lot of really long projects. That one is one that I didn't anticipate that would take so, you know, 7 years of my life. But it ended up being probably one of the more incredible things that we've managed to surface. And it is really mainstream compared to most of the work that we've done. I mean, you mentioned at the top that we were a label that was focused on obscure soul labels for our first 10 years. But we always thought that what we were doing was applicable to probably any genre or any artist. You know, like I said, come back to that software concept of you could run anything on it, you know, as long as it's good.
Well, I think too, you know, I don't want to give anyone the impression that we've only moved forward, because we've also moved back. You know, we've done a couple compilations like the Technicolor Paradise and You're Not From Around Here, which get into the sort of like sounds of like 50s and 60s cinema. And we've also done the Girl Group compilation, which also moved backwards from kind of where we started. And so I would definitely say that we've expanded, and what we have coming up is not just more 90s, it's a lot more 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s as well.
You know, the Blondie thing to me was the biggest surprise of anything you've done. I mean, just in terms of, that didn't seem to be in your wheelhouse. Like, you would be doing a relatively mainstream project, as you said, Ken, in terms of, I can't believe that the people who own the licensing rights or whoever, you know, wouldn't want to have done something similar. How did you get the, you know, the inside lane to work with the band and get that amazing project out, basically a career overview of Blondie's first era?
Well, it all comes back to the Ork Records box set that we did, which examines the early punk scene in New York, has the first television single, R.I.P. Tom. And doing that Ork box set really opened a lot of doors for us, because it showed a lot of people in that world that there was somebody who cared about their universe and wanted it to do it in a really respectful and elaborate way. Chris Stein had a copy of the box, but it was actually through our good buddy Steve Rosenthal, who ran this really incredible studio in New York called The Magic Shop. He turned me on to this barn full of tapes that Chris had up in Woodstock, and he was like, you got to go up there and just see what they have. And so I took a trip up to Woodstock and went and, you know, threw back the door and this thing, and it was just a giant wall of almost every Blondie master tape just sitting there in the elements, covered in rat excrement and dust.
Jeez.
And I looked at that and I was like, if there's not a project here, then I don't know how to do my job. And, you know, we got the tapes and we just started listening. And you're right. I mean, there was definitely some friction with Universal, who owns the recording rights. But there's also like a bunch of other stuff that's probably not worth going into on this show in terms of copyright and reversion and things like that, that sort of played into this. And we just happened to find ourselves in the middle of a really cool amount of material with a band that nobody over at the label was paying attention to at the time. And we created a blueprint for the project that we wanted to do. And from the moment that I kind of got into reissues, there was a guy who was sort of my mentor. His name is George Howard. He worked at a company called Rykodisc. And he always told me that, you know, when you sit down to make a record, that you should make the most insane and amazing version of that record that you would ever want to make. You know, like you dream with all the bells and the whistles involved. And then when people start telling you no, you scale back from there. So with Blondie, I went as far as I possibly could. I was like, how big and insane could we make this thing? And as it turned out, there were very few no's.
That's amazing. What's the response been like to the box set? Because I think
Grammy nomination.
Right. I mean, but you've gotten an amazing amount of press on it, I think. But I was curious about just in terms of, okay, a heavy lift in terms of just getting through all that red tape, bureaucracy, I would imagine. Has the reward, you know, justified that investment?
I don't know. That's a mixed question. It was really expensive in terms of time, right? So time is this commodity that you're never going to get it back. So however much time you spent on something, it's really hard to find a value to your own life. I think that we've been rewarded in a lot of other ways that are maybe not as heavily financial, in terms of showing the world what Numero is capable of doing, reaching out to a new fan base that may have never heard of Numero but is interested in a quality record. And so I think that the value goes beyond the monetary side of it, and really is like, hey, we want to be the best historical record company in the world. We want to be what people think about when they think about old music coming into light in a new way.
Rob, can you talk a little bit about the aesthetics of Numero? The packaging is always beautiful. The artwork's extraordinary. The liner notes are great. There seems to be so much love and care put into anything that comes with the Numero Group brand.
Well, when we started, you know, there was other folks in the space who were doing cool stuff, and you know, but everything was a beautiful box for Bob Dylan or a beautiful box for Miles Davis. And we wanted to give that same treatment to a Capsule or a Bodie Recording Company out of Cleveland, Ohio, which we did.
Syl Johnson or something.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I mean, you think Blondie's big. We thought Syl Johnson was big. That to us was a major turn into the mainstream. And now people are like, compared to Blondie, it's nothing. Culturally, it's everything, but it's so much smaller. Yeah. So we wanted to give that treatment to people that never thought they would get that sort of treatment. And so that to me is, you know, at the core of like why, you know, how we built our company and how we put things like packaging, such a huge emphasis on packaging and artwork. But under that, you know, we've always tried to put the person and the artist in front, or you know, in some cases it's the visionary who gets the treatment. So like, you know, we put Bill Moss on the cover of our first record rather than an artist. He's sitting there at the mixing board, and we found a photo that had been like torn apart over the years. That being our initial statement, we've basically stuck to trying to bring forth images from the time that capture something very deep about our subject, rather than, you know, we're not just looking for the glossy press photo, if they even had one. We're looking, or like a formal pose photo. We want to find something that's candid and that cuts deep into the subject. So, and we still do that. Now, you know, you do encounter situations where there just really isn't a lot of material from the time, but we still want to try and, you know, design, you know, create a design, create something that gets really close to the source.
I like to think of the people and the music that Numero is documenting as real people music. And so our packaging tends to sort of reflect that real life. It's like Rob was saying, you know, a crusty photo of somebody at a mixing desk or in their kitchen is sometimes so much more magical than that posed photo in a studio with a professional photographer, because it says everything about that world. You know, when you look at a photo, the most amazing thing about the photo is rarely the people in the photo. It's what's happening around them.
You know, we'll tell you our story, but we do have an aesthetic around liner notes, and that we try and keep the discovery out, right? Because, you know, when someone, there's no way to avoid that when the press talks about something, but we don't try and valorize the discovery, because these are people who have been living their lives this whole time and don't feel like they've been discovered. They've been doing their thing. You know, they were doing their thing then and they're doing their thing now. It's not a discovery to them. You know, so there is a little bit of a purpose to the way that we construct the stories that we tell as well. We don't treat it as kitsch. You know, we don't. There's no poodle skirts. You know, we're trying to. You know, we don't present a glossy view of what the world was like when these records were made.
I just listened to the Capsule thing, the label out of Columbus, Ohio, that you did a set on. And that stuff holds up. That music is amazingly relevant and still sounds wonderful. So there's nothing dusty about it other than the fact that it's made in the 70s. I'm curious about, because you have such a vast, how much you've grown. You've got all these different categories of music now in terms of the kind of stuff that you got, the Yellow Pills area, and you've got the Eccentric Soul, and you've got Cult Cargo, and you've got the Good God segment, which is... These are all a series of volumes around these different umbrellas that you've created. How do you guys marshal your time? The number of records you guys have put out is just remarkable. And how do you sort of decide what you're going to focus on?
I mean, it's a constant struggle how to manage our time, because that is, you know, the big trick that you learn at running a small or mid-sized business is that you have to run the business and do the things that you love, and figuring out the combination of the two is actually what's really difficult. Because I want nothing more than just to like pour through the pages of an old newspaper and find the like mysteries within or an issue of Billboard or Black Radio Exclusive. I mean, we do, when we have time, actually get our hands very dirty with this, but we're also running a business and have to manage our team, it's not like we can ever really not touch anything on some level, because we're just too small of a business, you know? So we need a new table in our lunchroom. I wish I could just assign that completely, but it actually like ends up being something we have to like spend some energy on.
Well, if you want a really nice looking table, you want to have somebody with good taste.
All right. Well, I would think that the table is the least of it, and the dealing with the lawyers and the Byzantine confusion of copyright law, and also with the artists, those must be the big challenges. You've had to have had some interesting conversations with some true eccentrics.
Every day of my life.
Is that better or worse than dealing with lawyers?
It's all part of what we do, and I don't really think of it. You know, I don't mind dealing with lawyers at this point. I've dealt with so many. We're all people here, and we're trying to make it work. It is very difficult to deal with someone with a fixation on some aspect of the past. You know, I've been, you know, I'll follow up with people who are sitting on a master tape that I know contains something cool, but we don't know what it is because it's never been released. You know, it's never been transferred, never been released. And, you know, I've had someone telling me that they don't want to work with us because, you know, there's still a possibility that Def Jam is going to approach them. That's the real life example. And now, and in that time, we've grown to be significantly bigger and be the kind of label that they should be dying to work with. But it's still just unclear to them. There's still like a vision, you know, of possibility of, you know, there's a dream, and it doesn't connect to any, like, while we've grown much closer to Def Jam than as they've grown closer to the grave, like, we're still not meeting somehow in a place of reality. But we've actually learned to take a much more zen approach than we used to, because these things, we do keep finding new discoveries that are really cool and that we're really excited about. And as long as that keeps happening, we'll keep going. One thing that's neat that's happened over the last 20 years is when we started, you know, when we went and met Bill Moss, who ran the Capsule label, we were basically, we were beggars and we couldn't really be choosy. But now when I give someone a call, I can confidently say we are the best people that you could ever want to work with, you know. Yeah. And that's given us a lot of freedom. And also, you know, it feels really good to be able to say that to someone. It feels really good. You know, some of the people we've worked with have, had truly life-changing experiences. And that's an incredible feeling.
When we return, we'll ask the founders of Numero Group about working with the supremely talented but highly skeptical Syl Johnson on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. This week, we're talking with two of the three founders of the Numero Group label, Rob Sevier and Ken Shipley, in honor of its 20th anniversary. Let's jump back into the conversation.
I have ultimate sympathy to this day that you worked with Syl Johnson and got through that and made such a great...
Yep.
That guy was just something else. And, you know, what a great artist. And at the same time, incredibly suspicious of everything and everyone who wanted to work with his music. That had to be just one example of dozens, if not hundreds, right?
But Syl is, like, the best teacher in a lot of ways, right? Because he made us be the best version of ourselves in order to work with him at every stage. And, you know, we started that out, the first calls that we were making with him, he was just so adamantly opposed to working with us. And then we wore him down. You know, he came over to our old basement on Marshall Boulevard and saw that we were just regular folk who wanted to make interesting, you know, decisions and music with him rather than the old way that he'd experienced it, where he was just sort of a, you know, like a pawn in a greater game. And I think that the years that we spent working with him were not only great for him because it showed the world that there was this really incredible artist that they didn't know that was just sitting in Chicago. But it also gave Numero an opportunity to get out of that basement and to look at making records from a more professional perspective. And to, you know, that there's kind of a great thing when you can level up because your artist demands that you be a better version. He's passed now, but we're still doing the kind of work that I know that he'd be really proud of. You know, I mean, it was amazing that we threw a party at our warehouse a few years ago, and I didn't know that Syl Johnson was going to show up. But then all of a sudden, I'm standing there, and I've got Ned Doheny, Syl Johnson, and Greg from Husker Du in a line, and it's just like, look at all these different generations of people that we managed to bring together. There's no way that Ned Doheny and Syl Johnson would ever be in the same photo otherwise.
Yes. That's great. We interviewed you in 2009, I believe, at Sound Opinions for the first time, and you'd been a label for 6 years, and at that time you had an amazing 23 projects out. I hesitate to ask, you know, how many now, but the question at that time was, it's 2003, guys. You just had this Napster revolt going on with digital music. why the hell would you want to start a label now? And here you are. How would you answer that question now?
I think we started at the best time, actually, because there was so much upheaval and everything was changing. And rather than be a nerd to the old way of doing business, which was like a CD forward, kind of stodgy, protective business, we really sort of opened our arms to the idea that we were going to be a different company. I always think also about like the crash in 2008 and how, you know, it's just like, well, we were just small enough at that time where we kind of didn't really feel it in the same way, you know, and it's just like, but it also showed us that we could survive some really tough things and be stronger as a result of it. As far as starting a record company, I mean, you can start a record company at any moment in time and it can be a good decision or a bad decision. It really depends on what are the things that you're bringing in to bring to the public, right? Like if you have a hit, it doesn't matter what era you're in, you know, a hit is a hit. If you're signing all misses, you're going to be out of business.
How many records have you guys put up?
Over 500.
God.
Wow. Wow.
That's amazing.
All right, let's project into the future. There's still people who have this dream of creating a label that connects listeners and musicians who may otherwise have been forgotten. Will that need continue? Will we be talking again on the 40th anniversary?
Yes, because there's a category of person that needs what we provide. You know, there's a category of artists that needs what we provide. And in some cases, you know, maybe the future holds some version of us being, you know, closer to like, you know, someone managing estates or something along those lines. It may not take the exact same shape for all of history, but, you know, it can go in a lot of different directions. But the people, the artists that we work with really do need us and benefit from us. And that is only expanding, and our kind of skills in this arena are only expanding. You know, 20 years ago, we might just have had some enthusiasm and a little bit of knowledge, but now we have a great deal of knowledge of how to navigate in, you know, an increasingly more complex world of, you know, connecting music with the listener. And it's not just a, you know, because it's so much of it too. It's not just the listener who knows they're listening. It's also like, how do you get it on a playlist that's played in every cafe that you walk into? How do you, you know, or boutique, or how, you know, we bring something vital to our artists. And it's not, you know, obviously at this point it's artists and their next of kin, or it's just their next of kin, or it's, you know, it's
their grandchildren.
In some cases, absolutely. You know, we're talking to, I talked to a grandchild literally yesterday who we dealt with her, you know, grandparent, and they were, and now they are the only generation that remains. And, you know, this is someone we started working with almost 20 years ago, 17 years ago.
Are you guys doing licensing as well? The rediscovery of Kate Bush or whatever, because it pops up on a particular soundtrack?
Yeah, we spend, we have a rather robust staff that does film, television, and advertising licensing. You hear Numero in a lot of really unexpected places, whether it's in a television show that you're like, man, T.L. Barrett. How many times have I heard T.L. Barrett in a television show unexpectedly? I didn't even know that it was going to be in there. It's gotten to that point where our team is so good that they're putting songs in that we can't even keep track of how many licenses we've done on it. I mean, there's this new television show that's coming up, and we've got 32 songs in the season. And it's like, wow. Well, that's the whole show, basically, wow. Right? And part of that is a product of having something that people really want, but also it's having really great people who work for you and can reach those folks. And then having music that fits in that place, you know, like something that we didn't have 20 years ago was like fake Italian sounding music. And now since the White Lotus, people want music that sounds like it's from Italy. And so we happen to have this song out of Youngstown, Ohio by Alberto Colombo. And now it's in an advertisement. And it's like, that's the kind of thing that when we started, we just had such a small handful of songs that we were working with. And so every single track that we got in a movie, or I mean, the time we got the Super Bowl commercial, they just felt so monumental. And not to be jaded about it, but you do lose track a little bit of everything that's happening when there is so much happening. It's not a brag. It's maybe more of like we're doing so many things right now that it's impossible for me to keep up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have time to watch TV shows, but if somebody's talking about a TV show, I can tell you what song we placed in it. And that's, you know, that's good enough talking point for me.
Tying in with that, I want to ask you a macro question because, you know, there was a lot of a feeling about where physical product is going to go. And not that you guys only do physical, you obviously do a digital component for all your releases too. But there's a lot of energy, it seems to me, among music fanatics or connoisseurs or people who really love music on a sort of deeper level than just top 40 or whatever, around really kind of projects very similar to what you guys have been doing for 20 years, which is that sort of deep dive into a particular artist or era or genre. You know, I'm thinking about, like, in recent months, there was a Charles Lloyd, a great jazz musician, you know, his trio records. And then there was another box set surrounding Music Concrete from the 20th century. It seems like there's a lot of energy around this kind of, okay, I want not only the music, but I want the liner notes, I want the photos, I want this kind of bigger experience with music that I really love or want to know more about. I mean, do you sense that that's sort of shifting a little bit? Obviously, that's, you know, part of what you've been championing for 20 years. It seems to be only growing bigger, that sort of market for that sort of deep dive stuff. Or is it just me being a music nerd liking that stuff?
Well, you're definitely dialed in a way that I think not everybody is, right? You spend your whole life thinking about music. Your job is to look at and to survey what's coming in. And so it's not a wrong opinion, but I do think that there's multiple segments in the market. You know, like, we're just as excited about making a streaming product as we are about making a box set at this point, because the possibilities are really different for those two types of things. You know, a track that is streaming can end up on TikTok, could end up, you know, blowing up and reaching a completely new audience that you've got no way of reaching with a $150 box set. You know, like, and to me, the most exciting thing about music is when it spreads. You know, like, I never wanted it to be something that we were, like, holding really tight to our chests, you know, and, like, trying to keep a secret. I'm not a gatekeeper by any stretch of imagination. If anything, I'm a gate opener. I think that the power of streaming is that we've completely democratized distribution and the ability for people to find things. And if you can create a platform and a unique perspective in the digital marketplace, you will find that there's more customers there than you can ever find with making a box set.
Although it takes longer for the artist to see anything.
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. I mean, you know, we've got an artist, Duster, which nobody cared about for the longest time. And now Duster's giant and it's all kids, you know, and I think that they're doing pretty well. I mean, like, you know, and I think it really depends on the scale of your artist and how much people are listening to, and streaming does reward listening. You know, if you're somebody who's putting up a song and you can't even get 1,000 people to listen to it, yeah, you're not going to make any money and you're not going to, you know, like, but also it's kind of showing you, it's like, maybe it's not good enough, you know, or maybe it's not the right time, because so much of music is timing. Coming out at the right moment with the right song that people, you know, it's like not everything is made for the moment that it comes out in. And that's what Numero is really good at, right? Is like resurfacing something and being like, this is something that the world missed. Let's pay attention to it again.
An example, I mean, Greg, I know you're a Bruce Springsteen expert, or I don't know if I'm being too generous, but you're some sort of Bruce Springsteen expert. You know, he just covered a Jackie Chan song on his last record. Yeah. I don't know if you caught wind of that, which, I, you know, we can't tie it directly to the box compilation that we released, but it is pretty convenient that it, you know, a year or two after we all got a Grammy nomination for that, he was recording.
Here you come again. And you say that you're my friend. But I don't know why you're here. She wants to know how.
Well, you can tell.
It does seem like, you know, there's some cultural inroads happening at a higher level
Yeah, and that's a great example. By the way, I really hate Springsteen's version of that song and just about everything else on that record. I'm not a big fan of that.
Sound Opinions producers, please loop that.
But an R&B, you know, transgender singer, you know, that deserved a lot of attention, more so than that person got when they were making records regularly. It's wonderful to see that sort of thing happening, and you guys do that very well. We do the DIJ Desert Island Jukebox thing, but I want you guys to pick a DIJ song from the Numero catalog of the 500 records, one song that you would take to the desert island with you. I mean, it's an impossible question.
You go first, Rob.
I would say, I do want to throw a recent track that I've been really obsessed with, which I feel like is just not really getting much attention, which is Joey Edmonds' Blue. I really think that's a strong track.
I'm blue. The moon drifts out of sight. Then I'm all alone out on the cloud, drifting and dreaming that I'll never, ever love again if I can't love you. And do I feel blue?
Not a lot has happened with it so far, so I wanted to bring that one to light as well.
I didn't even know you liked that song. Like I always thought it was like a little maybe too crooner for you.
It's one of those tracks that grows on you the more you listen to it.
It really does.
Obsessed with it.
The way that his vocal is in that song, it's like you wouldn't expect. Uh-huh. It's really like Johnny Mathis kind of inspired sort of singing, but it's behind.
It's like, got a Rat Pack. It's got a very Rat Pack feel, but it's sort of like what you want the Rat Pack to sound like. And they always kind of lean. Do you know 66? I want to say.
And it was done up in Wisconsin at KUKA. Which is like the studio.
So it's got like a little bit of a supper club thing going. You know, it's got a lot happening. You just really have to you have to bury yourself in it to find it.
For me, it's probably Charlie Magiera, Tomorrow's Gone. If either of you have dug into the Magiera universe, but he was this Israeli version of like Lux Interior meets Elvis, and he put out 6 or 7 albums, you know, after the turn of the century, and his 2000 record, The Optimizer, Mambo Chic, that record is just a classic that's still being discovered right now, and the track Tomorrow's Gone never fails to bring a smile to my face and to remind me that there's so much out there to discover, and that like you just
always,
you think that you've heard
more.
Everything.
That's beautiful.
There's always something.
Well
else.
Said, guys.
Rob Sevier and Ken Shipley of the great label Numero Group. We should do this every decade, fellas.
We should do Perfect. It more than once a decade, like maybe every half decade.
Good job, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
When we get back, Jim and I will share some of our favorite Numero tracks. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration.
Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. We just wrapped up our conversation with Rob and Ken of Numero Group, and now we want to share some of our favorite Numero Group tracks and talk about why we love them. Jim, you're up first.
Well, I'd just like to say, if anybody ever wants to buy me the greatest present of all time, the entire output of Numero Group, I would very much relish each and every one. But we had to choose some favorites, Greg. And I loved the Ork Records New York, New York 2-CD, 4-LP compilation, 2015, I think it came out, honoring Ork Records of the 1970s. One of the great independent labels that flourished around CBGB and was dedicated to documenting that scene. Some of the bands would go on to bigger success. You know, we tend to forget that many of those CBGB punk progenitors got signed to the major labels pretty quickly.
Right.
But others stayed in the realm of indie. And I'm going to go with honoring one of the great indies, a single that came out in 1977 on Ork. Both sides are on the Numero compilation, Mick Farren, Play With Fire and Lost Johnny. I'm going to play Lost Johnny. Mick Farren, what a character. I don't know if you ever got to meet him or interview him, Greg.
No, I did not.
Mick Farren was a Brit, and he was punk before punk was punk. In the middle of 1967, the summer of love, right? Psychedelic insanity with the Pink Floyd and everything that's happening in that scene in the UK. He's playing punk rock with the Deviants, partly because they couldn't play, and partly because Mick was always angry at the world and letting it rip. He was big with the UK chapter of the White Panthers, very political. Later in life, he'd become a novelist after a mid-period between musician, music critic, one of the main voices at the NME for many years, and then a novelist. I got to give a shout out. I don't read a lot of fiction. Mm. I'm a nonfiction guy, right? Literary journalism. And when I read fiction, I don't read science fiction. But I've read several of Mick's books, and there's a classic, Jim Morrison's Adventures in the Afterlife. I cannot recommend this. This is a bonus pick here, because I'm going to, giving all this praise to Mick Farren. Jim Morrison is in heaven, or whatever the afterlife is, hanging out with Jesus Christ, Doc Holliday, and romancing Amy Semple McPherson, who was an evangelist who now turns into sexpot is the word that Mick uses. Insane, right? Everything about Mick Farren was insane. I had got to know him because I interviewed him for the Lester Bangs biography, and he turned me on to, he said, you know, if you want to understand what criticism can and should be, you must read Oscar Wilde's essay, The Critic as Artist.
Mm-hmm.
Changed my life. really did. I force my students now to read it. It's endless. You know, it's one of those endless Victorian screeds, but it's brilliant. Anyway, Mick, I think, was also a brilliant musician. Height of the punk heyday, working with a bunch of New York punk musicians, he records a song that he'd earlier written for Hawkwind and Lemmy. It first appeared on Hawkwind's Hall of the Mountain Grill, with Lemmy taking the lead on it. Occasionally, Motorhead would play it later in life and invite Mick up whenever he was in town. Mick Farren, although not nearly as well known as Lemmy, very much in the same mold, All right? Lost Johnny's just a ferocious slice of punk rock that I never heard before Numero. Lost Johnny by Mick Farren. Thank you for that, Numero.
Yeah, no kidding. That Orc compilation is fantastic, and it's great to have that stuff.
And it's got the Feelies on it.
Yeah, I mean, nothing bad about that one, and nothing bad about the Syl Johnson box set they put out back circa 2010, I believe it was. It was called Complete Mythology, which is a very appropriate name for a Syl Johnson box set. 4 CDs, 6 LPs. Basically documenting his period when he was a Chicago-based artist. If people know Syl Johnson at all, it's because of the hits that he recorded with Willie Mitchell in Memphis, Al Green's studio. He did a cover of Green's Take Me to the River that actually charted and did pretty well. That was the biggest hit of Syl's career. But his work in Chicago is... it's just criminal how underrated it is, and Numero did him a proper by just putting out this stuff in its complete mythological wonder.
Here is the entire career of Syl Johnson. Yes,
guy's driving a truck, and all of a sudden, his songs start appearing on the radio here and there. Turns this into a full time gig. His records in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, early 70s. Touched on all sorts of art forms. I mean, he was a quadruple threat: singer, musician, songwriter, producer. Soul and funk, blues, pleading ballads, a hint of pop, protest music. He was ahead of some trends, piggybacked on some others.
Yeah.
But there was really no style of music that he couldn't do something with.
Well, and as the Numero boys indicated, quite a character.
Amazing character. He was so proud to tell me that Wu-Tang Clan sampled 9 of his songs on one of their albums, and he got a paycheck for each one of them. So Syl did very well for himself. The connoisseurs of that kind of music really knew the good stuff, and Syl had it on his recordings. That's why it took on another life in the hip-hop generation. But I want to focus on one of the albums that was included in that massive box set, Is It Because I'm Black, 1970 album. Some people have called it the first black concept album. It was released a year before Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
Mm.
But it's very much in the vein of a lot of that music, which was talking about the black experience in America post the assassination of MLK. And he devoted an entire album to it. And here's a track from it called Concrete Reservation by Syl Johnson on Sound Opinion. That is Concrete Reservation from the great Numero box set, Complete Mythology. Get it? It is one of the gems in the, one of numerous gems in the Numero catalog.
Oh, it absolutely is, Greg. And so is the next one I'm going to highlight, Purple Snow, Forecasting the Minneapolis Sound. Prince didn't come out of nowhere. He didn't land in a UFO in good old uptown Minneapolis or Chaska, Minnesota, the suburb where he'd wind up opening Paisley Park. Talk about something no other
label would dive deep into. Four LPs again on vinyl, double compact disc. This is a set that looks at all of the funk, soul, independent, long-forgotten bands that are happening in Minneapolis, which was a fertile music scene even before, on the indie punk end, we had the Replacements and Husker Du, or, of course, Prince, you know, bringing Minneapolis and that sound, the Minneapolis sound, to the world, both with his own music and the bands he produced. So 94 East was a fairly traditional funk R&B band, came together in 1975 around somebody called Pepe Willie, the former husband of Prince's cousin.
Oh, wow.
Minneapolis yeah. is a big, small town. You have to remember that. And at one point, they say to this talented kid, Prince Rogers Nelson, hey, I mean, you can play with us, right? And he brings along his childhood best friend, Andre Simone, who'd go on to be a big part of the Minneapolis sound as well. So they're both like late teens, right, when they're playing with 94 East. Dance music, soul, funk. You can kind of hear the roots of what would come later with the time and of course, the revolution. Not quite there yet. Not the greatest thing in the world, but certainly for Prince completists, this entire box set and the artists that it highlights, you got to have it, right? Interstate 94, significant for two reasons. When they built the highway, they tore through a black community in Minneapolis known as Rondo, right? Just bulldoze it, much as we did parts of the South and West Side here in Chicago. And also, I will always have a special place in my heart for 94, because when Melody was born, I was living in Minneapolis. You got to remember, I lived in Minneapolis twice. Two different times for 2 years. Bringing my newborn daughter home in the baby carrier. And, you know, Minneapolis is nasty cold and windy, right? And we lived right across from an empty lot on the other side of which was 94, right? And the wind, like, whipped her baby blanket right off her I'm trying to get her into the house.
Yeah.
So I always think of that and Minneapolis, and I love this song, If You See Me, by 94 East, featuring a very young and hard to even pick out Prince, but he's on there, I promise you.
I don't claim no riches, any miracles, but I'm doing better.
East, If You See Me. You can kind of hear what's going to come.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It was in the air already.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And that's cool.
There's something in Minneapolis, man.
That's what I love about Numero, is that they highlight this stuff that was kind of underrated at the time because nobody knew what it was.
And underrated or unheard?
Later on, decades later, you realize how important it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly the case with Jackie Shane, an artist I knew very little about until Numero put out a compilation album a number of years ago. Jackie Shane, who is Jackie Shane? A pioneering transgender artist, performing on the Chitlin' Circuit in the 60s. Can you imagine that, being a woman of color who happened to be transgender, performing on the Chitlin' Circuit, which was basically playing in a bunch of clubs heavily in the South.
At the height of segregation.
At the height of segregation, at the height of the civil rights movement. It was a tough time to be Jackie Shane, but Jackie Shane endured and made some amazing records, most of which are compiled on Any Other Way, this compilation album that they put out, that Numero put out. Jackie ended up in Toronto, but was active throughout touring the country for a decade and had hits, was an incredible live performer. Some of the tracks on the compilation LP document a Jackie Shane live performance, and you could just see the vibrancy there. You know, people couldn't get enough of Jackie Shane.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, when cutting records in the studio, great records, but really didn't do much on the charts. Any Other Way is probably the best-known Jackie Shane tune, and that is the one I'm going to play, but it deserved much more attention that it got in its day. And thank you to Numero. We do have Jackie Shane in a positive light, realizing the greatness of what was happening in the 60s by this incredibly underrated artist. Dropped out of music in 1971, never returned, never really got the big comeback special, you know?
Wow, that's so sad.
Anyway, here's Jackie Shane, Any Other Way, the title song from the Numero Group compilation album on Sound of Me.
People have been talking since we've been apart, and when I pass, I hear them whisper, there he goes with a broken heart. But when you see my baby, here's what you say. Tell her I wouldn't have it any other way.
Any Other Way by Jackie Shane. A good one, Greg. But we could really do 3 or 4 whole shows just on our favorites.
Absolutely.
Unearthed thanks to Numero. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, speaking of our favorites, Shemeika Copeland, long overdue to have her on the show. Extensive interview, live performance. It's everything you could want to hear from Shemeika, and she's given it to us full on. Don't forget to check out her bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts as well.
Good, good stuff. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cox.
We done climbing.